Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Democrats held an 8-minute, 46-second moment of silence yesterday as part of the unveiling of their Justice and Policing Act, new legislation that would reform police procedure and accountability. Here's a bit of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at the event.
We are here to observe that pain. We are here to respect the actions of the American people to speak out against that, specifically manifested in police brutality. We are here to honor George Floyd.
On the line with us now is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, one of the co-sponsors of the Justice and Policing Act. Congressman Moulton, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So let's start there, Congressman, with the Justice and Policing Act. What are some of the specific reforms it looks to enact?
So it mandates the use of dashboard cameras and body cameras, something that I have called for a long time. It's something that good cops should welcome because it prevents them from false accusations and certainly protects us all. It establishes a national police misconduct registry to prevent problematic officers who are fired or leave an agency from moving on to another. We saw that happen right here with a police officer at the VA, and I brought this to the attention of Congress and to the VA leadership. It reforms qualified immunity, which, as we've learned, is this legal protection that that police have that really just sets the bar in the wrong place, and it means that Americans are barred from recovering damage just when police violate their constitutional rights, and that obviously needs to change. It requires the creation of a law enforcement accreditation standard, and it bans chokeholds as something that a tactic that police shouldn't use. So there are a lot of things in this bill that just try to rebalance the relationship that police have with their communities.
So, Congressman, there's a lot there. Nevertheless, some on the left are calling for even bigger changes. We'll be looking later in this hour at calls to defund police. That's become a staple at a lot of ongoing protests, demonstrations. Are you worried that this legislation doesn't go far enough to get support from the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think it's important that we not get too mired in the politics of this and just try to address the root cause of the problem, right? And we need solutions. People are dying on our streets, especially black men, and that has to change. I think, to me, the only thing that's missing from this legislation is this idea that it's not just about banning particular tactics or whatnot. I mean, we shouldn't have chokeholds, but frankly, there are a lot of ways to kill people. Perhaps if this criminal Minneapolis officer hadn't used a chokehold, he would have used something else to kill George Floyd. So what I've really talked about is how we need to not abolish the police. They serve a critical role in keeping us safe and keeping dangerous criminals off the street. But we should abolish the culture within policing that leads to the deaths of unarmed black men. We should abolish the culture within our police forces that leads to a lack of accountability in policing. Part of these reforms might mean reprioritizing the way we spend our tax dollars in this country. But fundamentally, we need to change the whole relationship police have with their community to ensure that they truly embody servant leadership, protecting and serving us all with integrity. Because if they uphold basic American constitutional principles, such as that we are all created equal, then they will behave justly regardless of what particular tactics or training that they have. That's something
I know.
I'm just going to stop you there
for a second. And I know you want to focus on real change. You don't want to focus on the politics, but it is a bill. And after it would come through the House, it would have to go through the U.S. Senate. How would one get a bill like this passed in this Senate? What would it take to make it a bipartisan effort and get it passed?
Well, it's really hard. But the outcry across our country for ending racism is not just a partisan cry. Frankly, Democrats and Republicans alike are subject to police brutality and subject to racism. And I think that increasingly people are recognizing that. Now, let's be honest. Do I have a lot of confidence in Mitch McConnell's leadership in the Senate? Absolutely not. He's failed to even bring up for a vote less controversial pieces of legislation than this. So the best thing that we can do to make sure this bill is passed is get rid of Mitch McConnell and his Republican majority in the Senate. I'm working very hard on that, by the way, with my Serve America PAC supporting great leaders who are running to unseat Republicans who refuse to take on tough issues like this in the Senate. But I do think that it's important to recognize that this is a national movement. This is not just a Democratic movement, even though the Democratic Party right now in politics and in Congress is clearly leading the way.
I want to ask you about the police itself. We'll move off the Justice and Policing Act now. Do you think that militarization of police departments has become an issue in the United States? And if you do, what do we do about that?
Tiziana, absolutely. I mean, I see cops who are wearing more military gear to patrol the streets of American cities than we often wore to patrol the streets of Iraq in a war. I mean, it's really just gotten out of hand. Again, I think it's important to recognize that simply taking this military gear away from the police is not going to fundamentally solve the problem, because even with the basic gear that they have, they can still do bad things. But one of the things I saw on the streets of Iraq, where we often had police-type duties in the Marines, is that there was a real difference between units that took an attitude of, we're here to promote peace and stability, and we are all created equal. Iraqis are not evil, versus people who were there who just felt, you know, we're here to kill terrorists. And the point is that we all received the same training. We all had the same tactics at our disposal, but it came down to the culture with which we approached our job and remembering that we were there to uphold American constitutional values and principles and set a good example for the rest of the world. And that's the attitude that needs to pervade our police departments. And let's be honest, that's not the case. I mean, even, you know, just take the killings out of it. I mean, there are plenty of cops that we all know who are just jerks. And
let's stay with that for a second, Congressman. And I'm sorry to be interrupting you. We have limited time, and there are a few things I want to make sure I talk to you about. The former Boston Police Department Commissioner Ed Davis recently wrote an op-ed for The Globe calling out unions, police unions, for being too protective of officers who cross the line. That is a cultural issue, and it can be a tough one for Democrats who historically have been pro-union. What is your reaction to the claim that police unions have too much power, are causing some of this culture, and how does one address that?
It is absolutely clear that we need more accountability in policing. And look, I support unions. I support the union movement. I understand that the role that they have and collective bargaining is important. But if they prevent accountability of police when people are literally dying on American streets, then that's a problem and that has to change. So it doesn't mean that police unions need to go away, but it does mean that they need to make sure that they're there to uphold our values and our principles and not to undermine them.
Congressman, last question for you. Ferguson was in 2014. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Rodney King was the early 90s. It's been a long road. Why move for this Justice and Policing Act now? And what will it take to make real change this time?
Because I hope that that George Floyd is the last time. And clearly, we have not done enough in the past. And you've cited just the relatively recent history of police brutality. But let's not forget, this goes way back in time before we had TV cameras or cell phone cameras to actually record this and share it with the world. So there is a long history in this country of racism. And sadly, there's a long history of police brutality. And we've got to make it stop. It's time for change. It's no longer time for delay or debate. We've got to change this. That's why this legislation that we have put forward in the House is so important, but it's also why this legislation is just a first step.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, sorry for the cough there, and thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Hope you feel better.
The call has gotten louder in recent days. Defund the police. Boston is no exception. Today, the Boston City Council held public testimony on the city's budget, where they heard from activists calling for a 10% reduction and then reallocation of the police department's funding. That's just one aspect of police reform people are calling for here. Two local activists join us now, Armani White, who's calling on the city to defund the police. He's a community organizer with the Young Abolitionists. Welcome, Armani. Armani, are you there?
I'm here.
So hopefully we'll get... There we go. Hi there, Armani.
Hey.
Yes, we've got you now.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, I'm glad to have you. Also with us is Brock Sader. He's co-founder of Mass Action Against Police Brutality. Brock, welcome to Radio Boston to you too.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, we also want to hear from you. Do you think we should defund the police? Where should that money go? What would the reallocation be? Are there other reforms that you want to see from the Boston Police Department, your own town's police force? Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So Armani, I want to start with you. The budget for the department right now is $414 million, and an ACLU analysis says that's four times larger than the Public Health Commission's budget, 15 times larger than the Neighborhood Development Department's. You are part of a collective of organizers across seven organizations pushing to defund the police. What does defund the police mean for your coalition? Do you mean completely defund? Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So when we talk about defunding police, we're talking about investing in communities. We're talking about putting our money where our values are. We believe that we can allocate 10% of the budget right now towards community instead of into increasing the police budget. So that's what we're about. And we're a broad coalition of organizations. So it's coming from a lot of different angles. There's organizations that focus on Latino communities, focus on communities that are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated, young people, Jewish people, Muslim people, people from all over are saying the same thing, which is that we need to invest in our communities. So
Armani, how did you land on the 10%? And where would that 10%, if it's defunded from the police department budget, where would you advocate for it to go?
Yeah, so when we talk about investing in our communities, we talk about basically the things that people have been talking about for a long time now, which is that we need more resources because we know that investment in communities actually deals with violence and actually addresses the harm in our communities. And so we would invest into programs that exist now and also create new programs that we know we need and don't have the funding for. And so, I mean, in some examples of just other ways that we can hire civilians, do construction details, youth workers and counselors can replace police in schools. And this is something that we know works as well.
So Brock, I want to turn to you now. You seem less focused on a percentage of a budget, more on police accountability and justice. What are you calling for?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that that's what the world is calling for. You know, most people who come to a protest, you know, aren't coming out to a protest because they're thinking about 10% cut in the budget. I don't know where this comes from. It's not coming from, you know, some popular demand. That's not a chant that they're saying on the streets. We want justice.
Are you
That's
against that, Brock? You sound like you're
am I against it? Well, actually, I think Minneapolis, you know, is kind of the model right now. If anything, we should disband the police. You know, we need to completely abolish the police as we know it. One thing for sure, you know, in the Terrence Coleman case, we know that police should have nothing to do with any mental health checkups, you know, for instance. But in any case, the heart of this battle...
Brock, let me just clarify for our listeners. Let me just clarify for our listeners. Terrence Coleman was a 31-year-old Black man who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, died on October 30th, 2016, after being shot twice by a Boston police officer after being called on a mental health call by his mother. I just want to make sure our listeners understand your reference.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. And that's truth. Most people should be aware of Terrence Coleman. That's part of what we're doing with Mass Action, is giving voice to a lot of these victims whose situation really was no different than a Mike Brown or a Tamir Rice or many of the other names you might hear in mainstream press. But, you know, they're happening right here in the Boston area. So the main demand in the case of George Floyd is, you know, that these cops be prosecuted. That's why people took to the streets, because the government didn't act in a timely fashion. It turned into a riot. And in general, that's why you see a protest movement that continues to explode into the headlines 5 years after Mike Brown. Because 5 years after Mike Brown, Darren Wilson is still walking the streets. Me and Hope Coleman went to Ferguson last August to stand with the Mike Brown family. That family's demanding that case be reopened. And that's what we demand in the case of Terrence Coleman, Usama Rahim, and Bo Ramsey White. For starters, here in the Boston area, we think that Rachel Rollins should reopen these cases. It's not enough to say that you're against George Floyd being murdered by that officer and that officer should be prosecuted. You have to deal with what's going on in your own home, in your own backyard.
Brock, let me give Armani a chance to come back in. Armani, what's your response to what you just heard from Brock?
Yeah, I totally think that we need to support those families here in Boston that feel like they, you know, didn't get justice. I personally actually know like Bo Ramsey's family. I think about that a lot, but I also just think that the focus of what we're trying to talk about is actually defunding police so that there's not that kind of situation that arises again. I think it is a part of the national demand right now. It's happening across the nation, in New York, in LA, in other cities. And so I think it's important for it to be lifted up here. You know, we just had, you know, thousands of emails sent in to city councilors. We had, you know, dozens and dozens of people who just testified to this point. So I think that it's important. And I think that I do agree with, like Brock said, people are coming to protest demanding a defunding of police, and that it's, you know, something that people care about. People care about also getting justice. People care about a lot of different things. And I think there's a large movement across the nation for all of this. So it's, you know, it's good to have so many different people working on it and so many people in the streets of all different races saying the same thing, which is to defund police and to invest in our communities.
So let's take calls. Our lines are filling up quickly. Go ahead, Brock, and then I want to get a couple of caller voices in.
Yeah, just to quickly respond, I just wanted to say that, you know, a demand to defund the police can be used oftentimes to counterpose it to prosecuting the police, which is the elementary demand of all the families. I mean, I've talked to Sandra Bland's mother. I've talked to Mike Brown. I've talked to Tamir Rice's mother, Trayvon Martin's mother, Oscar Grant's mother, Wanda Johnson. I tell you, I can guarantee you, they all demand the same thing. They want justice. And in this case, reopen the case is one of the main demands, because the vast majority of these cases never went to trial. So I would have to disagree with the idea that prosecution is not a national demand and not a central demand. It is the demand, I would argue. It is the demand of the world movement, prosecution of the police. And it has to
I do agree that, that's a demand. I hope I didn't say that.
Okay, that's cool.
I totally agree. I think what I'm saying is that I think it's all important. And so I want to make that very clear.
Let's grab a couple callers here at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Ken on the line from the West End. Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, hey there. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to say that I do support the effort to defund the police. Growing up, I've never had a moment, a kind of an OP moment where I felt great about having a police officer live next door. And I've always wondered how I would feel if I bumped into a police officer at a party. There's a sense of power and lack of accountability, which doesn't fit for our society and doesn't make sense for the amount of power that's held by somebody who can end my life without having to.
So, Ken, we're losing you there, and I think we got the main idea from you. Thanks for that call. I want to add one more voice here. We've got Brian on the line from Natick. Brian, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with the concept of defunding the police. I think that a lot of the police spending is on reactionary tactics versus the proactive measures of improving some of the systemic issues. The issue that I have is I think defunding the police is going to be a term that is going to get vastly misconstrued and then taken in the wrong direction as far as trying to garner national support and large support from all of society. I think that the defund term is going to turn people off and it's going to be difficult. I think they need to rephrase that to something that's going to be a little bit more effective. I think you're going to have a misconception that we're getting rid of the police, we're going to have no police, there's going to be panic in the street, there's going to be crime. You know, people are going to get turned off, especially I think in the Midwest. And I think that's something that the advocates need to think about.
Thanks for that, Brian. Let me turn back to our two advocates. Brock, Armani, what's your response to the two calls you just heard? Armani, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's there, you know, we need to defund and be smart about where we put our money and what we invest into. I come from a community where the relationship to police is not positive. I also come from a community where, you know, police are everywhere, you know, and I think that people wonder, you know, how much is being spent versus the effectiveness. And so I think we're trying to make sure that, you know, this 1% cut to the total overall budget, right? Like, it's not a huge cut. And it's something that we hear folks are starting to agree. Like, I hear most people, most of the people, you know, both in the streets and also I hear elected officials talking about that. I mean, we don't hear it clearly from the police union, but, you know, it's clear.
So Armani, let me take it from you there. Yeah, let me take it from you there. I want to turn to you, Brack. So you and Armani, to a listener like me, are talking about advocacy across a fairly wide continuum. I hear Armani focusing on reallocation of specific kinds of funding that could lead to better support and services. Our caller, Matt, who said that language defunding the police may be too controversial, I hear you saying, no, that's what I'm asking for. I want prosecution, accountability, removal of police officers. Do you agree that the term is a problem, or does it not go far enough in your mind? I'd like to understand that a little better.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, when it comes to civil rights and justice, I think there's always been pushback. It's not something new. I think that's what that speaker was saying. I don't think they were, at least from what I was listening to, it didn't sound like they were saying we shouldn't then do it or it's not worthy to be asked for. But yes, I mean, we live in a country that incarcerates more than any other country in the world. We we're a pro police community, frankly, and we have to move to a place to where we kind of rethink how we live in our communities. And I think that's already happening now in response to COVID. I like know in my community, folks are coming together so much to just make sure people get what they need because they're just not getting it right now. That $1,200 check wasn't enough for a lot of people. Most people at that.
Let's grab another call here, Brock.
Sure.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Let's get Matt in from Dorchester. Go ahead.
Hey, so my biggest thing is defund the police. That's the wrong term we're using. That's not something we should be even think about, because the problem is, as a police officer, you do 40 hours a year of what we call in-service training, right? So I grew up in the city, I still reside in the city, and I'm a police officer. And so the thing is, you do 40 hours a year of what we call in-service training, and very little of that training is mental illness, mental illness training. And a lot of it stems from there's not enough money in the budget. So, Matt, let me interrupt you for just a moment there and clarify.
Matt, are you saying you're a police officer?
Yes, I am. Within my department, there's training out there. There's training not provided by the department, but like the MPTC, the Massachusetts Police Training Council, they put out trainings. And there are trainings that we can attend, but your department has to compensate you for the training. And if there's no money in the budget, you can't go to this training. And then I want to know as much as I can. I would love to go into a situation and be, you know, for lack of a better term, armed with the most information about the kind of call that I'm responding to. Because there's only so much you can do when you go to a call with someone who's suffering from mental illness. I mean, you do your best to try to empathize with the person. But I mean, as far as I can only do what I learn in the class.
Matt, I apologize for interrupting you. That your point is clear, and we're running low on time, so I want to come back to. Yeah, please do.
To respond to some of these things,
Yes, Brock.
Yeah, basically, this is Brock from Mass Action Against Police Brutality. I would argue that the main reason people came out on the streets wasn't a question of people were protesting the level of funding of police. They saw what Officer Chauvin did to George Floyd, and they were appalled. But what made it even more appalling was that it took several days for the judicial system to actually act. So part of the problem is the same reason they were outraged. Many of us wanted to take to the streets weeks earlier after the Arbery case. But, the same thing. You have these racist vigilantes, one a former cop with a close relationship to the department, were never prosecuted, and then went through three DAs before the state government had to step in, and only in response to a viral video. So it's not just the police, it's the judicial system, it's the prosecutors, it's the judges. All of them are part of what is in the crosshairs of the outrage that is getting millions on the streets today, from LA to Chicago to South Africa.
So Armani and Brock, we have just a little more than a minute left. And I just want to ask you each, based on the calls we've heard, the comments that you've both made, the places where you're in agreement and not in alignment with each other, what is a pass forward? What's the next step to get real change? Armani, briefly, from your perspective.
We need to defund and invest in communities.
And Brock, how about you? What's the immediate next step that you're
basically
calling for?
Kind of even what Al Sharpton himself is forced to acknowledge. The whole country has to unite behind these families. What is their demands? Their demand is justice. How do you get it? Well, for many of these families, the first thing we have to do is reopen the case. That is the central demand that applies to the vast majority of these families who are tied to communities all across the country, in every city and town, in every state, red or blue. So here in Massachusetts, here in Boston, Mass Action is calling another demonstration for all who support the demands of prosecution to stand with the families of Massachusetts, who will be with us in front of the DA's office, Rachel Rollins, demanding justice Tuesday. So come join us.
And that's Brock Sader. He's a co-founder of Mass Action Against Police Brutality. Brock, I appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Armani White, a community organizer with the Young Abolitionists. Armani, I also appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Now let's put the call to defund the police into a public policy context, a larger policy context. Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers joins us to help do that. Michael's also former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Michael, it's been a particular pleasure over these last couple of weeks to be in kind of a sustained conversation with you as events have evolved since police in Minneapolis killed George Floyd on Memorial Day. From there to now, we've seen this emergence of calls to defund police, in some cases abolish police. There's a range of things that can mean. What do you make of the idea in general, and how radical do you find it to be? Or not?
Yeah, it's interesting because if you work in policy and you've been around these conversations, defunding is not a new term. It's what we apply to any conversation in policy. From a historical perspective, Reagan defunded human service and social services programs in 82, 83. We've had conversations about public health and whether it's defunded, or our pandemic response being defunded. It is not. I think we get so concerned and caught up in the words, but defunding is not new for policymakers. It's a decision about whether you're allocating your resources properly, whether you need to move money to a place that it's more necessary and more needed, and maybe investing more upstream to prevent the downstream impacts, like needing police, and investing more upstream in social service programs, youth programs, substance use programs, and so forth. So It is not this firebrand conversation that people should be concerned about. It is one we should have, and we should have it frequently.
Michael, I know you were listening to the previous segment where we were talking with Brock Sader and with Armani White, who were really taking very different areas of emphasis on police reform. One much more towards accountability, towards reopening old cases, prosecuting police. The other on budgets and where the money goes. The old phrase that comes back to me is, are you investing in prevention or detention? Is that yeah. all part of a larger landscape? And if it is, what other pieces should we be paying attention to in that landscape?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I sat listening to Armani and Brock and very encouraged. You know, we have a phrase in the NAACP, the courage, that courage will not skip this generation. And we're proud of that, that there are some courageous young people that are on the front lines pushing conversations around policy. I don't think that they were really disagreeing. I think it doesn't have to be an either or. Armani was arguing for defunding means reducing the amount of money we do upstream and or downstream in police departments and putting it upstream and investing in youth programs and so forth. I think it's a valid conversation. Armani would be sitting at the table with legislators figuring out what the budget should be for police departments. We spend about $115 billion or more on policing this country. Is that smart on crime or are we still in a tough on crime stance? So I think that's necessary. I don't think he was at odds with Brock. And Brock was talking about police accountability, transparency. We need that. I think he's right. We're marching in the street for that. And people are asking for justice for George Floyd, for John Crawford, and a whole bunch of other folks, Tamir Rice, across the country where we didn't get justice, DJ Henry here in Massachusetts. But at the same time, you can still talk about reallocating resources for police departments. You can have both conversations at one time.
Michael, I know you know that the city council in Minneapolis, Minnesota, essentially moved to, over the next year, disband its police department and take different approaches both to public safety and law enforcement. Were you surprised that they did that? And will they be able to achieve their aims?
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. I mean, I went to college in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I know that they tend to be more progressive. And despite how progressive they can be, and they had police training and all the stuff that you would typically look for in a police department in a city to say that they were progressive and they were responding to the risk of police violence. They still fell victim to it, and they still always fall victim to it because they weren't doing enough. I think the Minnesotans that I know, and I know the Minneapolis NAACP president, Leslie Redman, is on the ground right now advocating for change. They're willing to sort of blow it up and look at a new way of approaching how to provide public safety. And that includes, rethinking, reimagining what police look like. And in Leslie's case, and we've talked about it, whether they get rid of police to some degree and then start having more community ownership around policing their communities. And I don't know what all that looks like. I don't know. You couldn't get 20 black folks in a room or brown folks in a room that's going to agree 100% on all of this. But what I'm encouraged by is that the conversation is rich, that people are willing to have a conversation we couldn't have had 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Michael, as we move forward, we're going to hear more about these public policy initiatives around the country. It seems there's going to be a lot of work to rethink and reimagine law enforcement, public safety. What about those voices who express alarm or concern that this could destabilize public safety, that moves to really remove or radically alter police forces will cause violence, crime, destabilization?
Well, you know, I would warn those people who tend to be alarmists that we've defunded police departments over the years in the course of our history. So it's a matter of who's in office. Some people want to be tough on crime, and they really sort of come into office with this tough on crime rhetoric. And whether it's legitimate or not that we need that level of funding for police departments is almost never the case. There is definitely certainly times when there's investments needed in police department, but do we need the tanks within police departments? Do we need that sort of militarization that we're seeing across police department and the huge, significant investments in that equipment and that basically weapons of war that's being deployed in communities and particularly communities of color? no, we don't need that. So why not have a revisit of all that budget allocation and expenditures? And I think what you're seeing across the country is you're seeing young activists of all races and older activists starting to revisit that and say, no, we challenge you on how much you spend. And why not put that into a school system to prevent that kid from getting into crime or getting into those situations? Why not invest that into mental health services that will prevent you from feeling like you have to shoot a mentally ill person on our streets? And I think there's a legitimacy to that we all got to pay attention to.
Michael, in our last minute or so, we've been in a very different world since the beginning of this pandemic. And one of the things that we've seen is that response to the pandemic seems to be the innovations and the efficacy seem to be coming from local areas, from state and local government. Is this a case where we will see the greatest change happening in localities? Is that where this is going to happen? Or is there something like the Justice for Policing bill that we talked to Congressman Moulton with about? Are there prospects there as well?
Yeah, I think it's going to be all of the above. Credit to Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Senator Warren, Congressman Presley, Moulton, and others who are on the front lines of advancing this bill, particularly to the Congressional Black Caucus. There's a lot of substance there that will reform how we do criminal justice in this country. And quite frankly, it's long overdue. We have been seeing Black and brown bodies murdered, particularly Black men murdered across this country and Black women. And it's about time that we do the kind of reforms that are necessary. I say that's in large credit to the fact that we have socially conscious people who are now willing to take some risk and change that. But it needs to happen at the state level. We need Governor Baker on the same page. We need our legislature on the same page. We need our city, town managers and mayors on the same page. And I'm hoping that we're in that moment now.
And that's Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and member of the National NAACP Board. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Finally today, before we end the show.
Anthony Martinieri lives in Boston, on Prince Street, in the Italian North End.
Those are, of course, the opening seconds of the now iconic Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day TV ad from 1969. We marked the ad's 50th anniversary here on Radio Boston in October of last year. Since then, the story has won prestigious recognition, the Regional Murrow Award for Excellence in Writing. So we want to bring you back to those winding North End streets featured in the commercial with a now all grown up Anthony Martinieri and our own award-winning producer, Jamie Bologna.
Anthony Martinieri.
Where are we right now, Anthony?
Moncada Street in the North End.
Oh, my God.
How are you?
How are you, buddy?
I love you.
Let me show how you been.
Good, good.
Still smoking, man? Come on.
This is what it's like to walk the streets of the North End with Anthony Martinieri.
I know. My son's 15. I started late.
Oh, my God. 15?
Although he won't admit it, he's a bit of a local legend here, still recognized in his old neighborhood.
I remember getting letters. People say they named their kids after me, Anthony, and people saying, you know, my name's Anthony, and people, they stretch it out when they say it. It's the same way they do it, you know, in the ad. They sing it.
Did that bother you? Did that bug you?
No, it didn't bother me. I was like, you know, that's nice. You know, a lot of people, like it says, I named my son after you. That's an honor.
But let me back up, because maybe you've never seen the ad that made Anthony a household name. The commercial ran nationally on television for 13 years, starting in the fall of 1969, and it was produced by the then Lowell-based Prince Pasta Company. Now you can find it on YouTube. It opens with Mary Fiumara leaning out of a second-story window on Powers Court, yelling, "Anth..." Well, I could do an impression of it or play the clip for you, but maybe I'll have Jim Botticelli, he's the author of the book Dirty Old Boston, Four Decades of a City in Transition, give us a taste.
Anthony! The minute you say Anthony, they know what you're talking about. Especially if you say it in that tone. Anthony! If you say it in that tone of voice, they know exactly what you're talking about.
You're talking about Prince and pasta. But in 1969, pasta was not really part of the mainstream. Italian food for many Americans was SpaghettiOs and Chef Boyardee. Here's how Paula Taylor, she runs the Food and History Culture Tour Off the Eaten Path, describes the commercial.
It's a little bit voyeuristic in some ways when you see Anthony Martinieri running through the streets. But then it flips to being back in the kitchen where you see his mother making the pasta and the family gathering at the table, and it kind of shoots back and forth. It's really like a documentary in some ways.
And it wasn't only spaghetti. James Pasto, co-founder of the North End Historical Society, says the commercial put people just like him into the center of American life for the first time.
It was exciting. It was exciting to see us on TV showing Italian Americans on TV, which we weren't used to seeing. It was kind of unworldly, surreal almost, because we were on the map of America.
So the ad had a big impact. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But let's hear Anthony again talking about filming it.
And then the scene where at the end of the commercial where I come through the door, they says, okay, stand outside the door. When we say action, come in. So they said, no, listen, you've been running all this way. You got to act like you're tired. I wasn't an actor. I didn't know how to act tired. One of the guys that I was with, he made me run 15 times up and down the stairs until I got tired.
Up and down.
So when I opened that door, I was really exhausted. I wasn't acting. I was tired.
And the commercial ends like this. Everyone gathered at the table. The last one to arrive is Anthony, out of breath.
And as every family in the north end of Boston will tell you, Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day.
So I asked Anthony, how did this whole thing come about? How did a 12-year-old kid born in Italy come to star in an American national TV commercial? Turns out, ad men and TV producers walking around the North End were just about as out of place as pasta was in the American diet.
You can tell they didn't live around here, the people. So they asked us for directions.
What do you mean you could tell they didn't live around here?
Well, the way they were dressed, the way they looked, they had long hair. Back in those days, they were, you know, our parents always told us, stay away from the hippies, they're going to kidnap you. You can tell the way they talk, the way they dress, the way they look. You can tell they didn't live around it. Plus, we didn't even recognize them. Usually, in those days, you know everybody from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So my friends were like mean to them, like, get out of here before it gets dark out. You know, typical punks. I just gave them directions. And then about a few weeks later, they asked me if I wanted to be on TV.
It was iconic.
Peter Saronic is a former Boston ad man and now at Emerson College.
I mean, it was sort of a standing joke that Wednesday's a Prince Spaghetti Day, and it's probably part of our sort of Boston thing, you know.
So the ad was meant to sell pasta, and it did, but it also sold an idea of family, of Boston and of Italian Americans. And in today's terms, it went viral. Of course, a lot has changed in the North End since 1969. Back then, Boston was Balkanized, and the North End was mostly Jewish and Italian immigrants. It was walled off from the rest of the city by the looming green central artery. Here's tour guide Paula Taylor.
It was fishmongers, greengrocers, butchers with rabbits hanging in the windows, chickens in the back, lots of people hanging out in the streets. I feel like the neighborhood felt more colorful. There was lots of awnings on the storefronts. You don't see that as much anymore.
Among the many changes, Anthony himself is now in his 60s and doesn't live there anymore. Lifelong North End resident Mary Fumata, who played Anthony's TV mother, died in 2016. And Prince Pasta is no more. It's no longer made in New England, and it's now just one of dozens of brands owned by a Madrid-based food conglomerate. But still today, if you stroll down Hanover Street, you'll get a distinctly Italian-American experience. You'll see pastry shops, markets, and delivery trucks double parked. And you'll also see a more diverse group of residents and business professionals in yoga gear, maybe even walking their dogs. You'll see a Chinese takeout place and a Bank of America. James Pasto of the North End Historical Society says the commercial takes us all back to an older idea of the North End, as it once might have been, when it was a stopping place for new Italian immigrants.
I mean, I think the nostalgia is there now. It helped create something to look back towards, the North End of the 60s. It recreated the Italian-American neighborhood, in a sense.
So getting back to its impact, let's hear from Marguerite Bonapane. She's the author of 6 editions of the North End Italian Cookbook.
You know, it made people aware of pasta.
She knows a thing or two about the North End and about pasta. She's a former restaurant chef and owner, and she taught cooking classes there for more than 3 decades.
It is a good thing, which we took for granted, and there's no other food in the world better than a plate of spaghetti with sauce.
When she says taken for granted, she means for Italian-American families, pasta and tomato sauce was sort of a daily food. But for a lot of Americans, it was still exotic, maybe even foreign. Not anymore. Americans consume almost 6 billion pounds of pasta a year, or about 20 pounds per person. Although if you ask me, that seems a little low. But maybe the Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day tagline had something to do with that. Again, tour guide Paula Taylor.
People recognize it. What surprised me is people from other states recognize it. Having this tour, I get people on my tour from like rural areas of the country, urban areas. People from Texas tell me they love that commercial and that they were amazed it happened in the North End. I think in some ways that commercial also put the North End on the map as America's Little Italy.
For Marguerite Bonapane, now that the North End is very much on the map, it's also changed. And not just the neighborhood, but the culture.
No, those days are gone. As far as I know, it's not, it'll never be the same unless everybody gets smart and slows down.
Anthony Martignetti agrees.
Now it's like, everybody's rushing to be someplace, relax. You know, sit down, enjoy your family. They don't last forever. I miss those days. Sunday afternoons, my brothers, my sister. So every weekend, the whole family, it was a family gathering. Now it's like, you're lucky if you see your family once a year.
Why do you think that is?
Times have changed. I mean, things are so expensive now. People need to work two jobs. Back in those days, you paid $50, $60 a month.
For rent.
Now you're paying $3,000. Who can afford $3,000 a month? Not really.
So maybe you're feeling how I'm feeling right now. A little nostalgic for a simpler time. Maybe sad that there never seems to be enough time in the day to do all the things you want to do or see your family. And for me, this is the strength of the ad 50 years later. Because I get it. At the end of the day, it's just a television ad. It's trying to sell a box of dried pasta. But it's also selling an idea. The idea of a family sitting at a table together for dinner. That simple idea changed how a lot of Americans viewed Italian food and their Italian-American neighbors. And now, 50 years after it first aired, the commercial endures as a way to talk about where we've been and what's changed. Again, Jim Botticelli, author of Dirty Old Boston.
Yeah, I guess we've made that Prince Pasta ad sort of a metaphor for the times we lived in versus the times we live in.
And even though it's the late Mary Fiumara who leans out that second-story window in the North End to call Anthony, she's really calling us all to the table.
Anthony! Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.